We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, WILL, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. Late last week, the week ending July 24th, 2010, the Chicago area was inundated with heavy rains. Sunday the 25th, the Chicago Tribune reported the waist-high water had receded, and while the cleanup continued, the worst appeared to be over. Midwesterners to the west along the Mississippi River, I suspect they watched the news coverage with some interest and sympathy. 2 years ago, they witnessed the power and destruction of rising waters, a flood that killed 24 and caused billions of dollars in damages. The flood affects them still. This morning, we'll look at the flood of 2008 through the lens of one community in Iowa. Our guest is journalist Stephen J. Lyons. He's the author of The 1,000-Year Flood, Destruction, Loss, Rescue, and Redemption Along the Mississippi River. Lyons tells the story of the flood through the eyes of the people of Cedar Rapids. He explores recovery efforts, looks at why some move away while others rebuild, and asks, what are the long-term effects of such a disaster? Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. I look forward to your questions and comments. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Stephen J. Lyons' writings have appeared in numerous publications, including Newsweek, the Chicago Tribune, and High Country News. A native of Chicago, he spent many summers as a boy at his maternal grandparents' home in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The 1,000-Year Flood is published by the Globe Pequot Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Good to have you as a guest. How
Great.
Are you?
Thank you. Great to be here.
So the Cedar River crested on June 13th of 2008. 10 square miles of Cedar Rapids were underwater. When did the flooding begin? When did the waters recede?
The flooding really began the winter before, not the flooding itself, but the buildup to it. There was quite a bit of snowpack throughout that area, record snowfalls. And then people saw ice jams on the river in the wintertime. And then in June, it just never stopped raining. There were 11,000 rainfall records set in June in the Midwest. And it's odd in a sense, on the day of the crest, on June 13th, which is Friday the 13th, of course, it was sunny and beautiful. But that was just one let up in the rain that led to it. And you're right, it was 11 feet above the previous crest of 1929. It just never stopped raining in June, and that's what led to this. Residents describe it as the rain rising quickly, or the river rising quickly, and then receding quickly. And when it receded, the town was in ruin. It was, like you say, 10 square miles, or 14% of the city. The city is 124,000.
Yeah. Did they see it coming? I mean, how much warning did they have?
They had some warning. They could tell upriver in places like Waterloo that things were coming at a record level toward them. But there was still an idea of disbelief. Residents in Tynecheck and Check Village, the two neighborhoods I looked at closely, they both had experienced flooding in their basements periodically, certainly the 1993 flood, which was another 500-year flood 15 years before. They had seen some flooding in their basements. But they had no idea that it was going to be up around their rooftops.
Yeah. How was Cedar Rapids affected by the flood of 93, which was also another flood of biblical proportion?
Was not affected nearly to the extent of this one. Two of the people, or a couple that I interviewed who lost their home, Troy and Bev Simon, they lived along the river, sort of in a large lot, and they remember the water coming sort of toward their driveway, and they can see the river from their house, but so they didn't you know, it was not the kind of impact that the 2008 flood had, which is the fifth worst state disaster in the history of the United States. If you look at the flood damage to Iowa itself, which affected, I think, just about every county, was declared a disaster area.
Yeah. I want to come back and talk about the weather in a minute and mm-hmm. what lies ahead and disaster preparedness in the future and that kind of thing. But I do want to put a human face on this story. Tell us more about Beverly and Troy Simon. They emerge as two admirable people in the story. Their home was a total loss, yet they kept paying the mortgage.
It's incredible. They never missed a mortgage payment, and I suspect haven't missed one to this day, even though their house no longer exists as a physical structure. Troy and Bev Simon, I met them, I think it was three or four months after the flood. I met them in Cedar Rapids. They had been referred to me by another person in the story, Kristen Fong. They were living in Christian's house after the flood, after they lost their house. And they agreed to meet with me subsequently over a period of over a year. And if you met them, they would not, and I don't know what this means, but they didn't fit my idea of what flood victims would be. They have incredible faith, incredible religious faith, which was tested, of course, during this time. Bev worked as a hairdresser and still does. And Troy worked as a financial consultant, but had just quit his job with benefits to become a freelancer in financial help for finances. And so he had bought a lot of equipment, and they were all ready to get going, didn't have his, you know, got rid of his health insurance, and boom, this happened to them. I met them probably at the height of when they were wondering, what should we do? What should we do? They went to all their creditors to see if they could somehow work out a payment plan for items that no longer were functioning, that they still owed money on, you know, TV, things like that. All the creditors to a person said, no, we will not negotiate with you. Hmm. And by the way, rents went up in Cedar Rapids following the flood. People took advantage of the situation. There's no doubt about that But they were a wonderful couple to follow, because they actually grew closer to each other over time. And I thought it was a remarkable relationship and remarkable how they went about recovering their life without becoming bitter, without becoming poor me, which they had plenty of opportunity to do, and a lot of people, of course, did. They really held it together. They were an inspiration.
How were they? You mentioned faith. You mentioned that they had one another. But, you know, still, when you think about the loss incurred or losses mm-hmm. incurred, it's literally seeing your life, what you have built, disappear.
They had a beautiful little bungalow along the river that they loved and loved. They would sit out on the deck and they'd watch the bird life. They would watch raccoons and deer come into their yard. They describe it as a cozy little life that they had. In fact, a day or two before the crest, they were eating chips and salsa on their patio, looking at bird life. They had spent, hundreds of hours remodeling their house, scrubbing it down to the original wood floors by hand till late at night and early in the morning with, you know, just doing it themselves. When the flood hit, they watched their house flood inch by inch, because they crawled up to a hill nearby and watched their house disappear. They got most of the things that they needed out of their grandma's quilts, things like that, but they lost so much. When I saw the house and I met them for the first time at the house, there was a tree sticking right through the front window. And I said, was that a tree from your yard? And they go, no, we have no idea where that tree came from. And it was roots in. And the house was totally destroyed, and then eventually the city came and bulldozed it away.
Yeah. Well, while Bev and Troy and all the rest of the community of Cedar Rapids was dealing with this flood, and many other communities along the Mississippi and its tributaries were dealing with flooding, this part of the country and the nation as well were into this recession that we're still fighting our way through. How has the recession added to the picture of suffering and of recovery?
It hit at several levels, Celeste. One level is just the amount of money that was not available from the federal government to the city. It was slow in coming. It has to go through the state and then through the city. It takes forever. You never want to get in this situation if you can avoid it, but unfortunately, we can't always avoid it. Also, many shop owners and business owners were not able to come back. They tried to come back to some extent, and banks loaned some money, local banks, around Christmas time, Christmas of 08, going into 09, thinking that the economy would recover enough so that these business owners could, you know, make a little profit and come back. Well, obviously, it didn't happen. You know, we're looking at the worst economic situation since the 1929 Depression. As the mayor told me, Mayor Halloran told me, she said, you know, if we could have picked a worse time, you know, this would have been it. Recession plus a historic flood of historic proportions. Of course, you're talking about other communities down the way. There was, of course, Iowa City. They were trying to save books and that kind of thing. It wasn't quite as impactive on houses as it was in Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids is a town of 124,000 eastern Iowa, a city with a strong agricultural base. Greg Ierley is a very interesting character in the book. He's the city's flood recovery director. He had a great quote. He said, "We don't make sexy products. We make starch that goes into paper. We make foodstuffs, ingredients in crackers and cereal. We make ethanol. The sexiest thing we make is Captain Crunch. We're not a beachfront property. We make an anonymous contribution to our country, and people forget about us."
Stephen J. Lyons, our guest this morning here on Focus. He's the author most recently of The 1,000-Year Flood, Destruction, Loss, Rescue, and Redemption Along the Mississippi River. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with a phone call or by email. Join the discussion with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener in Champaign-Urbana. Line 1, good morning.
Hi, interesting. Can you explain the 100-year flood term? It does not mean you're safe for the next 100 years if you have one. And did anyone collect any funds from any source, you know, not loans, but funds to help rebuild? And this wasn't a dam bursting, so what about prediction by the Weather Service?
The prediction by the Weather Service was excellent. I mean, the models were excellent, but there's still a bit of disbelief that a crest could be 20 feet above the previous crest. I mean, that's an incredible amount. And if you see the Cedar River most of the time, it's a slow-moving, muddy, probably highly polluted river that runs through the center of town. The city that year and did not know what was going to happen, but they declared it the year of the river. The Chamber of Commerce was going to really pump up the idea of the river. But the river, for the most part, is probably ignored for the, you know, except by fishermen and people on their boats. But as far as the city, as far as boardwalks and things like that, they do not exist in Cedar Rapids. There's a levee you can walk along, which was breached. The terms 1,000-year flood, 500-year flood, they really don't mean a lot. It wasn't my choice to put this title on the cover, but in talking to meteorologists, it doesn't mean if you have a 500-year flood that you're safe for 500 years. Obviously, we've had two in 15 years, and Nashville's talking about their 1,000-year flood as well. So those terms don't mean a lot. As far as money coming in to help, of course, there were state funds that came in, Small Business Administration funds to try to help. There was FEMA. Some people took their FEMA checks and went to Las Vegas instead of rebuilding. So you had a little bit of that, too. And they hope that FEMA never comes back and asks for receipts. Also, at the same time, Cedar Rapids passed a sales tax. I think this was in March, a half a penny sales tax that would go to flood relief as well.
A listener, want to follow up?
Great.
Okay, thanks for the call this morning. 333-9455, that's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, will-talk at illinois.edu, the email address. So what are climate scientists thinking about what lies ahead?
Well, I think they're thinking we're going to have more frequency with this. Climate change is in effect. That's what I was understood. I was told by interviewing meteorologists. You have these microbursts, these storms that just sit over an area. And I'm not scientific enough to explain them exactly precisely. But for example, on June 5th of 2008, in the town where I live, Monticello, we had over 7 inches of rain. Mm-hmm. This is unheard of. We had places in Indiana that had 9 inches of rain in 24 hours. These are rainfall totals we have never seen before. And it's just a sign of a warming earth, of moisture being trapped and coming back up into the atmosphere, coming right back down. So I would expect we'll have more and more floods of this kind of proportion. I mean, we were seeing them every year, it seems, especially in the Midwest. Of course, we had the one in Nashville this year, which they are calling a 1,000-year flood. We've had floods, of course, in Grand Forks, I believe it was 1997, I believe, mm-hmm. in Grand
That's
Forks,
right.
North Dakota. Yeah. And a former colleague of mine at University of Idaho, where I went to school, wrote a book about the Grand Forks flood as a resident. And I used one of those quotes within my book. So I think what it says for climate change is that it's happening. We're past the point of turning the clock back. We're going to see more and more of this.
Yeah. So are disaster planners and responders rethinking preparedness, response, and recovery?
Well, I know they are in Cedar Rapids, but I think the 1993 model, the Cedar Rapids model, the Grand Forks model, now the Nashville model, there'll be more and more of coordination and more preparedness in the future, but there's only so much you can do. Cedar Rapids was lucky. Nobody was killed. They had an incredible outpouring, again, of the faith community that went house to house, making sure people were out of the houses before the actual crest, the night before they were out in force. The great thing about a faith community, in this case especially, they have the networks to call out people in a sort of a rapid response, and they come in droves, and they did great work on this flood. I'll say that. And faith has always fascinated me, not being a man of great faith. I've always been respectful of the role that faith plays in people's lives and citizens' lives. In my last book, A View from the Inland Northwest, I followed a Washington State County chaplain around for a year. I spent a day or so each week for a year following him around because he was such an incredible man of faith, and I wondered how he could... He was the, let me back up, he was a person, Ben Benthine was his name, who would show up at horrific accidents and comfort the survivors, also comfort the state troopers. The first responders go through incredible grief when they come across an accident. We don't always think of that. And I wondered, how did that person make it through day by day, seeing, you know, each accident after accident? And the same, you know, Christian Fong, another person of great faith, and also the Simons, you know, to see how they negotiated through this period of time was fascinating to me.
Yeah, Christian Fong is another very interesting person in this story. He's a relatively young man, like 30 something, mm-hmm. right, and just seemed so present, and also so thoughtful, and also, I think you use the word prophetic in terms of he could see, you know, what lie mm-hmm. ahead a couple of weeks from now, a couple of months from now. He shared with you some valuable insights about what was happening and what was to come. And I think this is also a part of the story where the situation, the flooding that had hit Grand Forks in 97 comes through. Because I think that some folks in Cedar Rapids went to other communities who had been through something similar and said, what happened and how did it play out?
Christian is a journalist's gift. He's articulate. He's bright. He's a Dartmouth MFA graduate. He's an Iowa resident. I don't think anyone loves Cedar Rapids more than Christian. When I met him, he was handling capital investments for Aegon, the big insurance concern that's part of the new Cedar Rapids in that city. Christian, the first time I met him, he took out a graph, which was sort of a disaster graph, and it shows how everyone's running on adrenaline at first. Everyone's just charged trying to save things, and so the graph is going up. But then slowly it goes down and down, and people become burned out. They stop going to meetings. In the Grand Forks example, 80% of all the city leadership, mayors, city council people, even priests, ministers, anybody in a leadership role, 80% of those people were gone in a year. They either retired early, they quit. It was just too much for the older leadership within the town of Grand Forks. Same thing happened over time in Cedar Rapids. The mayor is gone. City manager Jim Prosser left, under fire, by the way. The city council pretty much turned over. And so I got to follow that with Christian over the year that I stayed on this story. And you're right, Christian was prophetic. And one of the themes of the book, I think, is the idea that the public relations machinery for Cedar Rapids kicked in, I'd say, June 14th, the day after the crest. We're going to be back. We're going to be stronger. And then soon, you know, it was, we're back. We're stronger than ever. As Christian said, to be labeled a dying Midwest city is the kiss of death. Cedar Rapids was determined not to do that. But the reality was they weren't back. They were struggling to get back. It may take 10 or 15 years to get back. There are people just hurting and hurting in that city. As Christian said to me, and it's the title of one of the chapters, No One Loves This Hurting City More Than I, or something like that. And so he was a gift. He was again. You know, what he said was, more than ever, I love this hurting city. And being a person of faith and complete honesty, he was bothered by the, over time, he was bothered by being part of the public relations machinery. And he gave me an example of A Man for All Seasons, the film. The idea of holding truth in your hand like water, cupping water in your hand. And when you lie, that water starts running through your hand. And over time, who are you if you continue to lie? And that's the example he gave me. He could no longer do that. On the day of the one-year anniversary, Christian and so many of the people I interviewed, they did not attend any of the commemoration events. Or, you know, I mean, they had bands playing in the street. They had some silly things going on as well. And he said, what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to walk through the neighborhoods. And that's what he did. He walked through with one of his boys. And it just moved him to tears. It moved him to tears to see that the smell was still there. The houses were abandoned. The neighborhoods were abandoned. Who knows where half those people ended up. And the ownership was always somewhat a little sketchy in a place like Time Check. Maybe grandmother died and, you know, a cousin is living there, grandma or a grandchild. Or, you know, the mortgage is long ago paid off. The house is maybe worth $40,000 or $50,000, no insulation. These are working class people. These are people that worked at Quaker Oats. They worked at Wilson Packing when that was still going on. They worked at Diamond V, which is maybe the only industry right in that neighborhood. So Christian, yes, helped me so much. He no longer works at Aegon. He had a brief run for governor on the Republican side in Iowa, but quickly stopped that, and I think now he's doing freelance investments or investment counseling on his own. He's a wonderful man. We need people like that in Illinois, actually, in government.
We certainly do. Speaking of the state as an entity, how has the flooding affected the state of Iowa and its well-being or not so well-being? I mean, if we take a look at, you know, you just mentioned Illinois, and we know we've got so many problems here, so many difficulties. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's strained the economy there. I'm not quite up to date on the whole place. My main concern was Iowa. But any time you have a disaster that we're looking at $6 billion or whatever the figure is, it keeps changing. you're going to have a hard time coming back. Cedar Rapids is an important city in the state, and Cedar Rapids needs to come back for the state to continue to be successful.
There were two points at which people would become tearful when you spoke with them, and one was when they recounted acts of kindness.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of stories of kindness did you hear?
One story I heard was from Gary and Linda Seeger. They live down in Timechuck along the river. They have since rebuilt their home and moved back in and are determined to continue that neighborhood. It used to be a very tight neighborhood. Of course, now it isn't because so many people aren't there anymore. Gary Seeger, who's a Vietnam veteran, would never cry, would never say a word, an emotional word, I would say. When this happened, he really had a hard time. And when he broke down recalling, Linda was recalling something that had happened when they finally got to move back in and his grandchildren bought him a chair,
a
Lazy Boy recliner, yeah, which he'd had before. And that's when he really lost it. And as Linda was telling me this at her kitchen table in their Timechuck home, Gary was standing off to the side on a next to the kitchen counter, and he was just weeping. And what was amazing, there's an email letter in here from Linda that I think is amazing. Linda became a community activist and is to this day. She had never done a bit of activism up to until the flood. And so their roles reversed a little bit, quite a bit actually. And she said that the men softened quite a bit in her neighborhood. These are working class men. These are, they work in car shops. They work in manufacturing. They are, to use a cliche, the salt of the earth. Well, Linda became a leader in the community and still is to this day, has talked to CNN, has talked to the New York Times, and is just a fighter now. She didn't know she had this in her. Gary has taken more of a back seat within the relationship, and she's noticed this throughout the neighborhood, that men have become softer since this flood, and more emotional, better able to share their emotions. This is a man who saw everything in Vietnam, but when he looked in his house the first time, which is the other point that people would cry in front of me when they recalled the day they opened the door, when they finally got into those places. I can't repeat what he said on the air, but it was worse than anything that he'd experienced, because that was their home. I mean, we're talking about decades and decades of living in one place, being able to depend on your neighbors, having the kids play in the street, watching them grow up. This is what I call a dying American neighborhood the neighborhoods that don't exist anymore, that aren't being built anymore. And that's another theme of the book, I guess, is a loss of an American neighborhood.
Yeah. Back to this idea of Gary becoming maybe more open and becoming, maybe this is really awkwardly put how I'm going to say this, but I've got to say something here, more in touch, with his emotions, and Linda Seeger seeing something within herself that she didn't know she had. The ability to lead people and to speak out and speak up. One wonders if that's they see that as a good thing, or thank you all the same. If this had never happened to me, we'd go back in a second to the people we were.
I think it's a consequence, but I don't think it's a... Yeah, they would go back to pre-flood. Pre-flood rolls in an instant. A flood lingers so much, unlike, let's say, a fire where things burn up and they're gone.
Yeah. There are a couple of emails in the book from Linda Seeger, and I've got one here on page 72. It opens the chapter that is titled Economic Cleansing, an Activist is mm-hmm. Born. To give us a sense of Linda Seeger and the person she became and is becoming, maybe you would read that for us, and then we can talk about this idea of economic cleansing.
It's a fascinating term. I'd not heard it before. And this is an email from Linda Seeger. Perhaps you may not want to interview someone who is candid and vocal regarding so many citizens that are being treated like disposable people. Their needs pushed aside for more affluent projects that appear more attractive to the business community in the city. Using the flood as a tool in which projects that were on the drawing board long before the water invaded our lives can be pushed through as flood-related rebuilding. Time Check is a part of this community that was born and grew from the work and friendships of immigrants from so many countries. They all lived in harmony for decades before doing things, such things was politically correct. This blue-collar community was valuable to the moral and religious growth of Cedar Rapids.
Hmm. When did you first hear that term, economic cleansing?
I heard the term from another Time Check resident, Frank King. Frank King is the proverbial creaky, the guy at the city council meetings that asks the hard questions that you just can't satisfy with your answers for the most part. He's a squeaky wheel. Again, an older man. A lot of the people in Time Check are older. And he told me that the city was in the process of economically cleansing this area. They wanted these poor houses, these low-income houses, these working-class families. They wanted them out of there so they could buy or build condos and riverfront property and townhouses for the Rockwell Collins, young professionals, the Aegon professionals like Christian Fong, the people who live in what's called executive communities. Time Check is rough around the edges. It's a place where my grandfather worked as a bus mechanic for over 30 years. But it's got character and it's authentic. Everyone I met there was just an incredible human being. I mean, Frank himself no longer lives in the house that was flooded. He rebuilt it, and he allows a church group to be living there, a church group that travels around the country helping rebuild disaster communities. And he's doing this for free. They've moved to another part of town. But that's when I first heard the word economic cleansing, and I started hearing it more and more. And the idea, again, is to get rid of the low income, get rid of working class families, and instead bring in things that are perhaps higher tax base, higher money making, more attractive to young professionals that are choosing what city to move to, that kind of thing.
And when city leaders are confronted with this complaint from people, how do they respond?
They deny it in a way, at least they did to me, but at the same time, what I found and what was told me by the mayor was they had already gone to Grand Forks before the flood and had hired an architectural firm, and they had plans on the drawing boards for incredible green spaces and boutiques and antique shops. In fact, one of the drawings has a picture of a coffee shop that's called Soho Cafe. Soho has absolutely nothing to do with Eastern Iowa, but those were the plans that were given. In fact, the architect, Sasaki, I think is his name, helped design the Beijing Olympics as well. So they paid millions of dollars to developers, to architectural plans, to come up with a way to utilize the river in a more palatable way, let's put it that way. They didn't want, like my grandpa would be and me as a small child, fishing for catfish along the banks. They would much rather have the so-called green space and the joggers and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's got to be a tough situation though for community leaders to be in, because on the one hand you've got to bring new people in, mm-hmm. you've got to keep an eye out for what lies ahead, because it won't be 1,000 years,
right.
It won't be 500 years. Mm-hmm. So how do we prepare? How do we keep our city alive?
And
how do you balance those two things? How do you honor what is the heart of your city and yet prepare for the future?
It's an impossible situation. And city leaders, all the city leaders I met were great people, honest people. They had what I called the flood look. They were exhausted beyond exhaustion. The city hall, the jail, everything was wiped out. All the city infrastructure that was based on Goose Island, that was wiped out in the flood, and they've resettled to another part. I think something that Rockwell Collins gave them out in the newer part of town for their offices. At the same time, they needed to own up a little bit that they did see this as an opportunity. And maybe they didn't as much as they should have, and they got caught. They got caught in that. And that didn't go over well with the residents of these neighborhoods. In fact, Linda Seeger was telling me more and more when they would go to the meetings, the city officials referred to them as those people. They were no longer part of the city. They became separate, you know, almost an outlaw band. And that really caused a lot of anger. And it still does. There's a lot of anger and resentment within the city. And like I say, many of the city leaders are now gone. Hmm. They've left under duress, or they retired, or said the heck with this.
Yeah. Well, tell us about your grandparents and your summers in Cedar Rapids.
My summers in Cedar Rapids were wonderful. As a small kid growing up in Hyde Park, my mom was a single mom, and she'd put me on the train that actually stopped at Marion at the time. It actually went much farther. I think it went all the way to Seattle or Portland, which seemed so exotic to me. In fact, Council Bluffs seemed exotic. We didn't go that far. So I would get off in Marion and spend the whole summer there, year after year, as a small kid. And my grandpa would be waiting for me with his crew cut and chomping on a cigar. This is a man who finished about sixth grade, but for some reason couldn't read or write. He could sign his paychecks. My grandmother gave him checks that said, do not cash for more than $25, so he wouldn't be taken advantage of. They were Czechoslovakian in origin. They still spoke Czech. So my grandfather, who could not read or write, was bilingual, which I am not. So he would lapse into Czech when he didn't want me to hear something. And he'd be looking at me while he said it, so I knew it couldn't be good. And like I say, he worked as a bus mechanic for 30-some years down in Timechek. I got to see the bus garage again, and Grandma took care of two flower gardens, a big vegetable garden. She wore an apron and was barefoot all the time in Cedar Rapids, and she would go down to Czechtown with me. She'd take me down there to shop. Czechtown is a community, a neighborhood, which is based on ethnicity, and has traditional Czech markets, and has the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, which was the flooding of that incredible national museum was an iconic shot that was seen across the world. And it was a summer of fattening up. My grandmother spoiled me and fed me in incredible amounts of food. And in fact, I have her kolache recipe in the book. All her recipes were based on what we would see as unhealthy amounts of white sugar and lard, but to me it was Grandma's cooking, and there's nothing better than that. She canned, she froze, she cut the heads off chickens, butchered rabbits. It was quite an education for a kid from the city who was a bit soft, let's put it that way. So at the end of the summer, she'd come up behind me and grab my love handles to see how much weight I had gained, and then she'd be satisfied with that. But yeah. It was a wonderful upbringing. I was not allowed really to be inside during nice summer days. I was literally chased out with a broom by her. She could not understand what I was doing inside the house. What a difference today.
Yeah.
But there really wasn't a lot to do in the house, so it was all outside. It was chasing snakes. It was finding golf balls in the nearby cornfield that bordered a golf course. It was playing in the creek that I was told not to go near, building a raft. It was going to the pool. It was just so many things, finding worms for Grandpa so we could night crawlers so we could go fish in that filthy Cedar River. This was before the Clean Air and Water Act, so I imagine that I've taken a few years off my life.
Yeah.
But it was worth it.
Well, you know, speaking of that, another facet of the story is the state of our rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And someone told you the Mississippi should be treated like Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
Chad
Pograki.
Pograki. Okay. Yeah. I think that's a great idea. We should treat our rivers like national parks.
One of the great joys I had years ago was following Chad Pograki and his group. They go up and down the rivers, cleaning up rivers, and Chad started out as a pearl diver on the Mississippi River, and he got tired of camping next to refrigerators and washers and dryers on the little islands that make up the Mississippi. So he started an organization and started cleaning up rivers, begging for money for corporations that use the river, barge companies and the like. And now he's got this incredible organization called the Mississippi River Beautification and Restoration Project. I caught up with Chad and Quincy years ago on an assignment for another one of the magazines I used to write for that's defunct called Hope Magazine. And I went out with Chad, both my wife and I did, and we spent the most incredible day cleaning up the river with him around Quincy, and then met at the end of the day on the houseboat with him and a bunch of 20-year-olds who were having the summer of their lives. And Chad loves the river more than anyone I've ever met. And recently he won, I guess it was in 2002, it wasn't that recent, he won the National Jefferson Award, which is America's equivalent of a Nobel Prize for Public Service. That same year receiving the same award were Bill and Melinda Gates and Rudolph Giuliani. So you can imagine the caliber of this. So when he heard about the Cedar River flooding, he dropped everything. I don't know where he was on the river, by the Quad Cities maybe, and took his whole crew over to the Cedar River. And they started cleaning up, and they've been back several times since. But he thinks because the Mississippi is such an incredible waterway for birds and animals that it should be seen as the Yellowstone of rivers.
Yeah. How is all the toxic junk that gets into a river in a flood handled? And, you know, are community drinking water facilities affected?
Oh, everything's affected.
Yeah.
There were barrels of isotone. There were all kinds of things that got washed into that river. Chad and his crew were there taking out barrels, taking out what they could. But eventually, of course, it's going to end up in the Mississippi. That's where the Cedar River ends up. And then the Mississippi, you know, rolls into the Gulf. I mean, it's you do what you can, but I don't think there's any incredibly effective way to get every single piece of chemical. And the river wasn't that clean to begin with. All of Iowa's rivers are badly polluted. They're not fly fishing streams by any means. And it's something that we're always dealing with.
This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this morning, Stephen J. Lyons. He's a journalist and author. His latest book is The 1,000-Year Flood, Destruction, Loss, Rescue, and Redemption Along the Mississippi River. It tells the story of the flood of 2008 through the lens of one community, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And he tells the story through the eyes of the people of Cedar Rapids. We have about 8 minutes left remaining in this hour of Focus today. And listeners, if you'd like to join us, if you have a question or a comment, give us a call or join us by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk about another amazing individual in this story. We've got a call coming in, so I'll just ask you to give us a little bit of information about Leah Wilson, and then we'll take this call. She's another remarkable person in the story.
Leah Wilson at the time was the communications director for the National Czech and Slovak National Museum, National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, which is right down there in Czech Village along the river. I met Leah, and she was one of the first people to, of course, respond to she organized and helped clean up the library and get it back going. She was an incredible source as well. They're so committed to keeping that museum there, even though the building is structurally ruined, and they got most of their artifacts out. A lot of the books were heavily damaged. But they had people coming from all over the country, especially University of Iowa and I imagine University of Illinois, to help clean up a lot of the objects and a lot of the things. She's now in charge of major gifts for the museum. It is going to rebuild within the Czech community. In fact, one of the exhibits they have is walking through a 2008 flooded house. That's an actual, sensory experience that you can do.
It seems that the museum is in a way an example of what is possible in rebuilding and in recovery.
It is very much. They have a very strong director, Gail Naughton is her name, and they were determined to stay there. One of the donations they got, by the way, was $100 from the Obama campaign, which I thought was very interesting when I looked at the contributions that they had. But aside from that, their commitment, again, to stay within the neighborhood, to be relevant, to use this as a way to even be more relevant to the Czech population, the Czech community, is so important to them, and they're so devoted, and they stuck it out, and now they have enough money to rebuild that. It's a magnificent facility. If anyone has a chance to go over there, they really should look at it when it reopens in its new form.
Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I had a question about whether there exist good models for what is sometimes called gentrification, or as the author was talking, economic cleansing. I don't know. Boulder, I was recently visiting, maybe comes to mind, but I'm not sure. I think it's usually situations where there are three distinct population, the new professionals maybe moving in that is more of a mobile group and more static group in the town, and the students. University of Illinois doesn't have quite that situation because we really don't have that much of an industry coming in, but one day perhaps it might happen. So we also don't have a riverfront. But, I wonder if good models exist, whether all communities are, all the needs are served.
I think it's very difficult. I'm not an expert on urban planning, but to me gentrification means rich people moving into an area that was previously occupied by a more diverse, often a more diverse population, usually lower income than the people moving in, and they want to capture that authenticity, if you will, and get it on the fly. Money talks, you know. Money is what causes gentrification, and it's always going to be a factor. The power that these people have are a power that's not, it's not a commodity. But it's much craved, I think, by all of us to have a strong neighborhood where you can rely on your neighbors, where you can watch children grow up over generations. Frank King could, when I sat on his porch, he would look down the street and he would tell me the occupant of every single house on that street in time check. And I wonder how many of us could do that today, even know who's next door to us.
Listener, want to follow up?
My question is has to do with oftentimes the population that's moving in also might relish the idea of having a neighborhood, but for various reasons, some of which are clear, some of which are less, it doesn't quite happen. And also, I guess sometimes the population might even be more or less conscious of the fact what's going on. I don't know if there is any balance to be struck, and I appreciate that the author of the book really is not focusing on that subject. It's more of a side story. I was just wondering if, you know, maybe he has a good reference.
I appreciate your call. I know that Dan Kemis, who was the mayor of Missoula, Montana, has two or three incredible books about what it takes to build a community in a city. And, you know, we're an organic a society. We move around a lot. And I'm not trying to advocate one thing or another. I was just there as an observer telling stories. And I can tell you that people are hurting there because they've lost that neighborhood. They've lost that community. And that's a huge loss. You know, it's irreplaceable. Their lives will never be the same. I understand that. And I think they're coming to grips with that. You cannot put it back together.
Well, thank the listener for his call this morning. Mm-hmm. We're here at the point where we need to wrap up, and I think that the last question should be, you know, what have you learned? What have you taken away from all these stories that you heard over the course of working on this project?
It has made me even more, I guess, admirable of people in bad situations, how they act. Americans usually act in a good way. There was no rioting on the streets of Cedar Rapids. There was no looting I just am in great admiration of the people I met. I tried to convey their stories honestly, and I think I did. And, you know, we can't really avoid natural disasters, but maybe this book can help you, can inspire people to look at how other people handled it and how they went on with their lives, because things will happen to us, and not necessarily floods, but all kinds of things happen if you live long enough, if you're fortunate enough to live long enough. And how you cope is what makes a human being. And I was just very lucky to be able to meet the people I met and to tell their stories and to be welcomed into their homes during some of the worst times of their lives. Yeah. And I felt very humbled by that experience.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it there. I want to thank you very much for coming in and sharing the story with us this morning on Focus.
Thank you, Celeste.
Stephen J. Lyons is the author most recently of The 1,000-Year Flood, Destruction, Loss, Rescue, and Redemption Along the Mississippi River. The book is published by the Globe Pequot Press.